Blog Talk Radio.
Tornado. Hey, we're on time. Listen to this. Hey, all right. Wait a second. What's going on there?
Well, what'd you say?
I had a clip to start off the show, but this is playing. Anyway. Might as well just kick. We'll listen to it later if we can get us to come up right. This is Rabble Rouse and Rich Bergeron, by the way.
Yo, it's the Tornado, Tony Pennycow.
And I don't know if you saw, Tony, I sent you a link earlier today about last week's show. We actually made the news, even though they didn't mention us by name. I put a comment on there. They'll hopefully keep with the link to the show. But our last week's guest, Danielle Cajon, made the news. She's taken Herb Dean's referee class. And there she was on Yahoo News. And she mentioned that, last week she met Kim Winslow and did a radio show. And it was fun. So we got our compliment if we didn't get mentioned by name. So.
Hey, you know?
Right? Big boxing news this week, in more ways than one. The clip I was going to play had to do with a story that I was going to mention last week, but I didn't. This week, actually, it's gone the crossover to make it a combat sports story, not just a boxing and basketball story. But apparently, you know, this guy, Jeremy Lin, he's a superstar now with the New York Knicks, came out of nowhere. And he just all of a sudden, he's just doing awesome and carrying his team to all these victories. And he even made a racial slur on ESPN about the guy that has nothing to do with this story. But, they wrote a headline about a chink in the armor of the Knicks. And, they thought it was funny. One guy got fired, another guy got suspended. Not only did they write it, but one guy said it on the air. You know, and how could you not think of that ahead of time? It's uncalled for.
Well, granted, I was 21, 22 years old when I said some dumber things. I mean, I still say dumb things, but I remember I was in college. I was thinking about it today, actually. A friend of mine who was a fraternity brother, and I wasn't in the fraternity. We were both journalism majors. We were both wrestling fans, pro wrestling fans. And he was a big Ric Flair fan. So he put something in the paper. The school newspaper, he used to write like a column. And he wrote something about Ric Flair in there. So I went back on there and I bashed Ric Flair. And then he said, like, bashed him. Just, we saw Tony the other day and he was wearing his 414 shirt and that's not a fraternity. And then he passed out and was doing vomit and everything. Well, of course, we were just, taking little pot shots at each other and having fun. But Dr. Cox saw it, and Dr. Cox was not a happy camper. And everyone was telling me, he goes, you know what? He goes, even if you are not boxing at Las Vegas anymore, he's like, you are still a part of this team, and you are still well known in this town. And he's like, you got to be careful what you say. He goes, and right now, the fact that you're talking to me, that, I'm still... I was battling some legal issues at the time for my house getting busted. He's like, that's the last thing you need getting out right now, even though it's a joke. He's like, it's making you look like these charges, that against you are really serious.
Well, this story involves actually Dana White pointing to a footage that Floyd Mayweather Jr. wrote. And here's the quote exactly from Mayweather's Twitter. Jeremy Lin is a good player, but all the hype is because he's Asian. Black players do what he does every night and don't get the same praise.
I forget who it was. It might have been one of my Facebook friends. My one Facebook friend, I think it was him, countered that point with.
Yeah. Well,
all the praise because he's black. White
golf players do that all the time. This kind of flew under the radar at first, but I guess Dana White wanted to make a big deal out of it. This is an easy shot to take at Floyd. I mean, I think he does stuff like that just to generate discussion, but it's kind of amazing to me that they're even quoting a boxer as an expert on basketball. You know, like he really knows a lot about basketball. I know he's, you know, a big betting guy, but I don't think he makes most of his money on the basketball games. But anyway, you know, he's trying to say that black guys need more recognition for whatever reason. That's the message, I think. Sounds like a little jealousy, if you ask me. You know, he's used to being compared to legends. So, it's kind of funny. Another story came out this week, too, about Manny Pacquiao and Floyd Mayweather's discussions before the fallout of their fight arrangement. Now, of course, there's talk of Pacquiao retiring after Bradley, but we'll see. I think he's going to try to make the Mayweather fight. But regardless, I guess the big bone of contention was that Pacquiao, actually, in an interview, he called Mayweather personally, one-on-one. And Mayweather's argument was, I'll give you a $40 million flat fee for the pay-per-view. That's it. You know, we'll agree to the fight, 50-50 split for everything else, I guess, on the purse. But he had to agree to just a $40 million flat fee. And he called it embarrassing. Pacquiao's own words. I called Floyd and told him that we need to make this fight happen. He said he could have whatever he wants, blood testing. But he said, oh, well, I will give you what he wants. Then he mentioned the pay-per-view. So, basically, that's what ended up. He wanted to give him a $40 million lump sum payment if he agreed to let Mayweather keep all the pay-per-view earnings for himself. So, either he didn't really want the fight to happen right now, or he got a little overzealous on the arrangements. But, you know, I think it came closer than ever for a reason. It's got to happen soon. It's probably going to happen November, December next year. Or, I mean, this year. And then Pacquiao will retire. But seems like that is it's a peculiar arrangement to try to make. Unless he really didn't want the fight to happen, you know, because if you believe what Pacquiao said, he said he could have the 50-50 split, you know, was something that everybody was talking about, but that's obviously more like a 10-90 split. If you give Mayweather all the pay-per-view money. Which is, they all know is both going to be the most money generated is going to be from that, of course. It's a no-brainer. But messed up. Anyway, UFC President Dana White made it a point to call out Floyd himself and talk about how much of an ass he is for saying the stuff about Jeremy Lin and not fighting Pacquiao. And that clip isn't playing for us tonight, so you have to check that out. It's also on Yahoo. Let's see what else we got. Story this week about CTE in mixed martial arts kind of trickled out about Gary Goodridge. He doesn't necessarily blame mixed martial arts, but he says he has early onset chronic traumatic encephalopathy. And he's basically, you know, been an all-around fighter. He retired in 2010 after 7 consecutive losses in various MMA promotions, domestic and abroad. And his career spanned 14 years and included 46 MMA fights. But he also fought 38 kickboxing matches and hadn't won a kickboxing fight in 4 years when he hung up his gloves. So, we're not talking super competitive fighter. He was just a guy who was an opponent for much of his last years in the game. So he took some damage. But it's interesting, he will not blame MMA. It was definitely kickboxing, he says, because that's where all the knockouts came. The whole thing about K-1 when I was in Japan was knockouts. I guarantee you people that were there that fought more than six times, we all got brain injury. It's kind of makes you wonder, right? Is that why K1 folded? They were dealing with these issues like football. Anyway, he also said every one of them has got what I got. The reason why the company liked me is because every time I fought, there was a knockout. So it's kind of an interesting claim that he makes. And it comes at a time when there's a big study that's going on now. There's actually multiple studies that we could talk about. One is from Virginia. And researchers in Ohio and West Virginia set out to simulate head and neck injuries sustained during hook punches and test whether these risks are mitigated by available head and hand padding. It's an interesting study. Since you and I, we love to throw hooks. the researcher found that padding lowered linear but not rotational impact dosages and did not eliminate the risk of brain strain injury. These findings can be found in the Journal of Neurosurgery, so it's a peer-reviewed study here. They had a crash test dummy representing a man in the 50th percentile, whatever that means. A pendulum was set up to deliver 54 blows to the left side of the head, replicating a right hook punch at low and high impact, and then the head was tested bare covered with padded boxing headgear in this study. And they found that all impact conditions involved in padding reduced linear but not rotational impact dosages delivered by the hook punch. Not surprisingly, the best overall reduction in impact dosage was found when boxing glove and headgear were both used. However, a heightened risk of brain strain injury was associated with both boxing and mixed martial arts, regardless of what padding was used, obviously. And this is an interesting part of this whole thing, is one of the co-authors of the study is an amateur boxer, or was in the past, and is currently a ringside physician. Yeah, supposedly those are just preliminary results, but that's just one of the things that's going on. There's another big study going on in Las Vegas that the UFC is actually encouraging people to volunteer for, because they're convinced how safe they are. And that's kind of the study that's been making more news. That's out in Las Vegas. I think they're looking for 150 participants to do that one. But anyway, we have some pretty big boxing news this week with some big guys fighting all in one night. I mean, you talk about the heavyweights division getting to the point where it's going backwards. I mean, it's going back to Tyson's antics the days after he got out of jail when he was really crazy out there. Lots of press conferences.
It might be going back to Tyson's antics, but guess what? It got people talking, didn't it?
Oh, yeah. It was like 3 days in a row, nothing but stories about David Haye and Derek.
Yeah. Well, I didn't get to see any of the fights live this weekend. I was in Lock Haven for the boxing show. I will touch on in a little bit. Great time, as always. Another thing, before we get onto this, before I forget, I'm at work today, you know, causing a ruckus, and I get an email from one of our sales reps who works at our Lehigh Valley area, and she's like, hey, I got a new sale. We want to start at the first week of March. I look at the person whose name, the owner of the business that I am going to be providing pest control for,
mm-hmm.
by the name of Larry Holmes.
The real Larry Holmes?
So I told the Larry Holmes.
Wow.
He has a restaurant and a hotel in East NPA. So I told the sales rep, Kim, I'm like, I will give you a business card the next time she went there and she'd had drinks with him. She'd had lunch and drinks with him. I said, give the guy my fucking card. But knowing Larry's personality, I've only met him once.
Mm-hmm.
He's still very, like, kind of standoffish. Yeah. And I know, like, the two things that really hurt him, one was coming after the error of Ali, Frazier, Foreman, coming on the heels of that, where he's got guys like Greg Page, you know, Tony Cubs, Mike Weaver. Those are all the guys that were, you know, around his time frame. So he never had that great opponent for one. He didn't have Ali's personality. He wasn't beloved. Like, I mean, he was almost like standoffish, like what the Foreman was, but it wasn't the great charismatic Ali to slay him.
Well, when I grew up watching boxing, I didn't really know any of the history, unfortunately. You know, I just knew what was going on in that day. Tyson, of course, was the number one news story and number one draw on HBO. So, you know, that's the one channel we had. And I used to watch all those fights and everything. And I saw live the Larry Holmes versus Mike Tyson fight. Of course,
sure.
I'm always going to remember Larry Holmes just rolling like a sack of potatoes on his back.
Yeah,
that fight looking like crap, and you know you never want to go out like that, and that's the reason why. Because you know, even years later, when I know so much more about Larry Holmes, and, coincidentally enough, we did interview somebody who fought him before. We had Butterbean on.
Oh, we had Butterbean. We had Ray Mercer on.
Yeah.
I think we had two, three. Well, we had at least two, but we had a couple guys that fought Larry Holmes.
Larry Holmes, so. That's the way I remember him, but I would definitely love to talk to him about all the other fights, and you know, you never want to.
Yeah, I mean,
do with a guy.
You probably will not want to tell him that you did work on the Marciano website. Because I know he still gets a lot of flack over the Rocky couldn't carry my jockstrap comment, and I know he said it in the heat of battle, failing to break Marciano, time Marciano's record on a controversial loss to Michael Sting. But, you know, he said it in the heat of the moment, and 30 years later, it's still, like, literally hanging over him. And I only met Larry once. My two favorite Larry Holmes stories. And there's a fight this weekend up at that hotel in Allentown, and I might still go to it. I'm not sure yet. But it was this show in Allentown, PA, about 40 minutes above where I live now, about an hour above Philly. And they have, like, you know, they have a commentator. This was, like, on, like, a local Philadelphia channel, like, some, you know, like a CNA or whatever the hell it was called. So they had these fights being there. And Larry's doing full commentary, and here comes his nephew fighting. And his nephew looks like he's cut out of granite, and he's fighting this short, little fat, oh, he's a short, fat guy. He's got a gut hanging over his basketball shorts, and he didn't have high-top sneakers on. Larry's nephew is slapping him around, you know. This kid's out of breath after 20 seconds. He uncorks a right hand and knocks Larry's nephew out cold with Larry doing the commentary. I'll never forget that. And the other one I'll never forget is about 10 years ago. We're there again. I'm there with my neighbor and his brother-in-law. And Larry takes some pictures after the show's over. My neighbor and brother-in-law go up and go, can we get a picture? Absolutely. He poses. I snap the photo. I go, can I get a photo? Yeah, I'm going to be quick. I'm like, well, that's kind of rude. I took the photo, and it was before I had the camera. I developed it, like, 2 days later. And Larry's got this sneer on his face, like, pissed off to be standing next to me. So I realized I'm wearing a Rocky Marciano shirt.
That's a good story. Anyway, we have to quickly connect with our first guest. I know I didn't really tell anybody yet who we're interviewing, but we did a big preview today, so if you and by the site, you know, we're going to be talking to Sean Loeffler, who on the very night, just moments before his purported debut there in the UFC, he's back in the locker room area, getting ready, warming up, and steps the wrong way on his ankle, snaps his ankle to the point where it was a softball in minutes, and lots of fighters were around to see it happen, and no, it wasn't. It wasn't like the Kimbo Slice, Ken Shamrock deal, where he got cut minutes before. You know, this is like a serious thing that just kind of happened, freak accident. Loeffler was 25-5 going into this fight. And the UFC gave him a shot, and they really believe in him because they're going to pay for all the recovery issues, surgery and all that. So we're going to be able to talk to him about mixed martial arts and the medical policy of the UFC. But he's going to come on at 8:15, he said, so we're going to get to him. He's got a class at 8:30, so I get him. My clock is
This is Sean.
Hey, Sean. This is Rabble Rousing Rich Bergeron. How's it going?
Hey, good. How you doing?
Great. And we also have Tony the Tornado on the line with us. Tony Pettacow.
Yo, what's up?
You guys there?
Yeah, we're here. Sean, obviously the big story this week is the ankle injury there. Tell us a little bit about the background of how that happened.
I mean, basically, the simplest version of the story is I'm 4 minutes away from walking out from my UFC debut, waiting 12 years for the opportunity. And, of course, the story of my freaking life, I do 5 more tuck jumps to get a last little explosion, plyometric, jump before I walk down to the cage, laying in a crack in the mat, and my ankle pops a bunch of times, it explodes, I jump back up, start shadow boxing because my adrenaline's pumping, thinking it's not that big of a deal. I then fall down again, and I realize I can't stand up. And then UFC comes over, Joe Silver, the doctors, and they're like, Sean, we can't let you fight on leg. I was like, dude, tape it up, carry me to the cage. I'll blow my money out like I do. I'll make it rain. I'll sound like the Karate Kid, and nobody will know the difference. I think I'm nothing anyway. And then I'll just swing with the guy, and whatever happens, happens. I'm fighting. This isn't a ballet. Let me get in there. They're like, Sean, we can't let you fight on one leg, and you're not allowed to tape anything that's not a cut. And I said, cool, then just give me a knife. I'll flip my freaking foot open, and then you spit, and then I go and fight. And they said, Sean, I'm really sorry. We can't let you do that. So that's pretty much the short of it.
Nothing
like this, nothing serious, just your basic rolling your ankle and whatnot, but nothing to the extent where I have it now where I need surgery and I'm going to be off of it for a little while,
And is anything broken or is it primarily ligaments and stuff?
Now I came back and it's a complete disruption or a complete tear of the anterior collar fibular ligament. And then there's a complete tear of the deltoid ligament, and then partial tears of all the medial and posterior tibular ligaments. So they put surgery back to Tuesday, and they're just going to sew everything back together so my ankle is attached to my rest of my leg again.
So how long do they think it's going to take rehab?
Well, the good thing is they thought they were going to have to get a cadaver tendon and put the cadaver in there and then put some pins on the inside of my foot. And when they did an ultrasound on Tuesday for the pre-op, they decided, Sean's tendons are so strong. We don't want to put in some cadaver tendon or pins that are, potentially weaker than what he already has. They're like, so we're going to do what's called a Bronch strength procedure, which is we're just going to sew your torn ligament and tendon back together, and then they say you're going to stay off of it for 2 weeks straight, and they're going to do some plasma-rich replacement therapy, which is like where they put different types of blood with, or your blood with different types of, minerals or something. I don't know, not blood donor, but something like that, where they shoot in different types of, blood and minerals through the ankle for 2 weeks, and then I start rehab for 6 weeks, and they said, realistically, 2 months Tuesday, I should be able to train 100%. Now, obviously, I'm not going to be in the type of shape that I'll be to train 100%, but I'm thinking 5-6 months from now, I'll be fighting in the octagon.
So, they really
okay.
Not too bad.
They've given you the Cadillac of insurance coverage there, it sounds like.
Oh, yeah, the group is amazing when it comes to their insurance and everything. So, and they've been, obviously they're going to take care of me regardless, but they've been over the top cool. The insurance people for them are like, you really care how much it costs. They're like, we need to get you back in there. We're marketing you, and you're going to be a superstar. They're like, take care of you. Do whatever you got to do. They're like, if you have to do 10 surgeries, do 10 surgeries. Like, this is on you. And Greg from the UFC and everybody's just been amazing.
Yeah, I have a history of going back and forth regarding how much fighters are paid and stuff sometimes, but you know, the insurance coverage was a big step, but I admitted that from the beginning. That's a very good idea. It's one of the things I hope becomes a standard in the sport. And the UFC, I mean, they really live and die off their fighters. I mean, that's how they make their money, so why not take good care of them? That's one thing they do. Although the base pay gets a lot of attention, that's one thing, you know, I even give them credit for every now and then. Being a critic of some of their policies, I will be the first one to admit that they do go out of their way to, you know, try to make sure the fighters are taken care of when they have injuries with this.
And some of the guys and Burt from the UFC told me, and this is before the injury, it all even happened. This is 5 days before the event. They said if anything happens 30 days after the event, you're still covered by group insurance. So if you start training and something happens, and you think it might be because of something in the fight, whether it's a torn fingernail or your eye starts hurting, you know, 7 days after the fight, whatever, they're like, you're covered. So within 30 days, record it and get it taken care of. So when it comes to that aspect of things, they've been really great, you know?
Well, I actually never even went to the hospital when I had my last severe ankle injury about a year and a half ago. So I can tell you you're up for an interesting recovery time. I mean, you're obviously going to get much better care than I got. But, you know, just even, you know, dealing with the pain and everything from something that swells like yours did, I think I had a break and a ligament damage, but I'm still recovering. I haven't really rehabbed.
Yeah.
Stays in you forever if it goes the wrong way. So I hope your treatment goes well and you take it seriously. I mean, if I could go back,
I'm pretty fortunate being in Southern California. I think there's some very, very highly recommended high level orthopedics and podiatrists here. For you know, working on my foot, I got Dr. Tal David. Is doing a surgery. I think the Chargers foot doctor for the San Diego Chargers football team, and the rehab is going to be done through him and the other Reichel physical therapist. I think Kobe Bryant did some of his stuff with them in Long Beach. So we've really looked into it and pulled out all the stops, like you said. Because I'm a professional athlete, we're not going to F around and do half-assed or you know, try to have me walk on a too early train. I'm gonna baby it, and then once I'm ready, then I'm gonna not let it be a mental crush ever, and I'm gonna you know let them go and chase some people.
Awesome. Now, why don't we change the subject on that one? Tell us how you got to that point where you were getting ready to go out for that UFC fight. What got you noticed, you think, and what's some of your good memories from? You know, being a fighter, getting to that point.
You saying before the UFC?
Yeah. How did you get noticed by them, and you know, what were some of the highlights of your career?
Well, I mean, I think one thing everybody notices with me, I'm an exciting fighter. I kind of throw caution to the wind. I really don't care about like other people that are standing across from me. Like I just. If you sign a contract to fight me, in my opinion, that's like a slap in the face, and that means, like, you think you can beat me up and take money, and, like, kind of a gangster, so I'm like, what for? Like, all right. And then I get kind of, like, offended that you would say you could fight me, because that means you think, like, you could beat me, and then I just get, like, I look at the guy, and I think of all the things that I've been through in my life, and so I kind of go out there like a madman. I'm throwing Superman punches and flying knees and head kicks and shooting, you know, high crosses and trying to throw people out of the cage. And you know, I throw punches with expiration dates in 1974. So everybody's like, damn, that guy goes for it. And sometimes it works out for me, and sometimes it doesn't. And 25 times it's worked out for me, and 5 times it hasn't, especially. And I just go. I like to be exciting and entertaining, and I think that's what the crowd likes to see. And I can do it for 15 straight minutes, 25 straight minutes, but usually with that style of a martial artist, it tends to make fights a little bit more definitive than the Olympic wrestler, you know? And I would say that's what the UFC likes. My buddy Larry was in contact with Joe Silva through email, and a couple other people had brought my name up in the past to Joe, and he knew who I was, and,
And then when Larry got a hold of him and said, hey, Sean's on a 6-fight win streak, won a couple of belts, just fought a 6-2 guy, knocked him out in 6 seconds. A couple of fights before that, fought a 5-1 guy, knocked him out 55 seconds. What do we need to do to get him in the big show? He's been fighting for 12 years. And then next day, Larry had an email in his email box. He's not a manager or anything. He's just one of my buddies from Joe saying he doesn't have to do anything else. He's in the UFC. And I was like, yeah, baby, let's do it. Oh, it was crazy. Quabby, my business partner at the gym that I own, the compound here in Oceanside, she talked to Larry that morning because he was just freaking out, knowing, like, oh, my God, like, this is going to change our life. So she went over to, I bought a house on my 29th birthday. We closed escrow. And so she runs over to the house because it's about half a mile from the gym at 7:58 in the morning. And she's pounding on my window of my bedroom. And I'm like, what the hell is going on? I'm like, is this an earthquake? And I'm like, is somebody breaking into my house? And I open my eyes and I'm like, Claudia, what is wrong? She's crying. And she's on the phone. I'm like, oh, crap. I was like, something happened to my twin sister or my dad or not again. Like, I've been through a lot of tragedy. So in my head, I was just like, holy gosh. Like, this is some, like, I'm getting woken up with bad news. You gotta be kidding me. And so it was January 8th. And I put my boxers on, so I'm not answering the door naked. And I go, what now? And she goes, take the phone. And I go, just tell me what happened. Like, I'm over this. I'm too much disappointment in my life. Tell me what now. She goes, I'm not allowed to tell you. It's not my right to tell you, take the phone. And then Larry's on the other end. And I'm like, is my dad okay? And he's like, yeah, what are you talking about? And I was like, what's wrong? He's like, nothing's wrong. And I go, well, dude, why are people pounding on my windows? It's 7:58 at the moment. Like, what the hell's going on? He goes, Sean, you're in the UFC. And I'm like, who's hurt? Like, what's going on? He's like, Sean, you're in the UFC. And I'm like, yo, and is it my dad? Is it my mom? And he's like, Sean, you're in the UFC. And then I just fell to my knees, and I was like, what? Like, after 12 years, you never really think you're going to get that call, you know? And so I had, like, tears in my eyes, and Claudia's jumping up and down. And from then I looked in my pants, and I threw out all my cereal and threw out all the Oreos and went to the organic store and got food because I needed to start cutting weight.
Awesome. Well, I'm sure that, you definitely earned your spot there, and you obviously impressed a lot of people if they were that upfront and quick about taking care of you after the accident happened and promising you a spot in the future. So they believe in you.
Yeah, I mean, Joe's so awesome. And Dana, and they're like, you're everything we want in a fighter. We know you're going to bring it. You know, you're definitely not a sissy. And I was like, no, I'm bringing the hammer. Like, I will entertain people. Like, when lose a draw, people are going to remember me. They're going to say, that guy looks like a cartoon character. He's got a rainbow mohawk and covered in tattoos. He's throwing money out. And the guy spins around like the Tasmanian devil when he fights, and he throws punches that'll probably kill, like, you know, adolescent boys. So, yeah, that's what we want to see.
Fights, I mean, I've noticed, just not from actual competition fighting, but when you get in, you know, sudden street fights and stuff as a kid, and even as a grown up, I've been in a couple. If you have too much to think about what you're going to do, your true instincts don't come out of you in a fight, you know? And I've been in a couple brawls.
Yeah.
I actually had one boxing glove on. I was screwing around with a kid, and the brawl broke out at a party, and I broke some kid's nose. He was 2 inches, you know, 6 inches taller than me with one hand. He had a big nose, of course, but I broke it, and there was blood everywhere, and I only got punched once running out the door. Some girl grabbed me off the pile after a brawl broke out, and some kid sucker punched me on the way when they pushed me out the door. But, man, it happened out of nowhere, and I didn't have time to think. Even when I was a kid, when I got into fights, that's how it worked. I always did better when I was taken by surprise and had to react naturally. Rather than thinking about it and agonizing over it and, you know, wondering what's going to happen, you know, you're just thrown in a situation. If you're a good fighter, that's where you do your best.
I'm one of those guys. Yeah, I mean, I'm just one of those guys that's not big into, like, game planning and stuff like that. I'm more of like, I just want to know what I'm going to do the first 3 seconds of the fight. That's what I tell my coaches. I'll call my opponents at. I don't freaking care. I only plan out the first 3 seconds of the fight. I mean, obviously in training camp, we work to counter all the stuff my opponent's going to try to do, and we try to work on my strengths and a little bit off of his weaknesses and his strengths and so on and so forth. But more than anything, I just worry about the first 3 seconds, whether I'm going to circle the right, circle the left, come straight forward and jump and punch you in the head or whatever. And after the first 3 seconds, like you said, you're going to fight. So if you try to plan it out more than that, I think you'll mentally bog yourself down to be like, oh, shit. Things aren't going the way I planned. Like, this isn't a game plan. This guy's imposing his will on me. This and that, he'll be taking too much. So I just have to say, okay, you know, I'm going to circle the right and I'm going to kick him right in the face. And then after that, we're going to be fighting. If I miss a kick, we're going to be fighting. If I land the kick, we're going to be fighting. But when you like try and stick with something, you end up running around the cage, chasing wrestlers around. Don't want to call anybody out on that.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me when I was a junior, it was my first wrestling in high school. And I ended up being in the JV state tournament because it was at my high school. And, you know, I kind of started winning here and there. And I can remember before the very last fight, I just, you know, laid down in the middle of the arena looking up at the lights and wasn't thinking about anything really going into that match. I just went with the basics and I ended up getting the kid in one of the quickest pins in my wrestling career. And I still
nice.
It's one of the biggest trophies I ever got in wrestling. So, you know, it just goes to show you, you know, no matter what kind of combat, if you clear your head and you don't agonize over technique and stuff like that and just let it flow, that's the best method. I mean, the three-second rule, that's a great one. That should be standard in everybody's training camps. Don't think beyond 3 seconds. I like that.
Yeah, I mean, there's no reason to think beyond 3 seconds. If you're not realizing you're in a fight more than 3 seconds into the fight, you're probably in the wrong sport. Because this sport, we don't have teammates or bats or hoops or courts. We just have balls. We only have two, and they're connected to our waistline there. And those are about the only set of equipment that you go in there with. So you swing them and see what.
Tony, you're
going to
say something?
Or
you're
going to
cut off there?
Yeah, what I was going to say, when we were talking about, you know, scouting and game planning and doing things like that, I was actually talking to one of my students last night that I'm training. And I'm a traditional boxer. You know, I boxed in the amateurs. And now I train, you know, a couple of young guys for boxing. The one I'm going to, you know, encourage him to get into some amateur fights when he gets a little bit more experienced. And I was telling him last night, you know, it's good to have an idea of what your opponent, his strengths are. And it's good to have a general idea of what you want to do in there. But as I told him, I said, I was one, as they called it, an aggressive counterpunch. I brought the fight to my opponent in the hope that he would punch first to keep me off of him. And then when he would punch, it would open up, you know, holes for me to throw my counterpunches. And I said, I was very much a freestyler. I said, as you see, when I work the bag and work the pads and everything, even still, I said, I don't know what I'm going to do until I'm already done. And probably the best game plan I ever had going into a fight. When I tried to do too much of the game plan, I often was freestyling. I did a lot better. That was because I was playing off what my opponent was doing. And I was at my alma mater last week, Lockhaven University, and I remember my senior year, I was actually fighting a guy that Rich ended up fighting in the Nationals that year by the name of Michael Jordan. And we had no scouting on him. We had not seen him. He never fought off the post at the U.S. Military Academy. And the best advice I ever got in the dressing room was from Coach Cooper. And we even talked about his very quote last week. He said, you know, you're in front of your crowd for the last time tonight. This is the last time you're ever going to fight here. You got all your friends. You got all your family here. We don't know nothing about this guy. And so the best thing you can do is go out there and punch him right in the mouth as soon as you can and get that crowd fired up and get into his head. So when I went out there and, you know, we threw a couple of jabs at each other and I punched him directly in the mouth with a left hook and the crowd erupted
and then he countered with the right hand, and I walked through it, and I punched him in the mouth again, and the crowd erupted again, and I dominated the rest of the fight because I got into his head, and I backed him up doing that. That was the best strategy I ever did.
It definitely
punch him in the mouth.
First strike, too. Even in wrestling, when I was wrestling in high school, the coach used to always talk about these two kids. They were actually twin brothers, and they had the quickest move off the line for the low ankle. They grab you by the low ankle and just kind of toss you right on your ass. And they're lighter weight guys, so they could get away with that. But, just faster than anybody I'd ever seen. I saw him in action a couple times, and I was like, yeah, I don't understand what it's like these guys. Gotta get that first strike in, set the tone, make it a good one.
Yeah, no, I agree with that completely. I agree with one that just said completely, because my coaches tell me every time when I start a fight, they say three things. And it's always the three things. And just like you just said about boxing, Nick, he said, Sean, pull the trigger, let your hands go, make this guy taste his own blood, and he'll want to go home. And they just repeat those three things to me before every fight. They say, Sean, pull the trigger. Sean, let your hands go. Sean, make this guy taste his own blood, he'll want to go home. And like, you know, like you just said, when I do that, it changes the whole next 15 minutes, 5 minutes, 5 seconds, doesn't matter how long it is, because you know it's you're going to fight. And when you know that you're going to fight a little bit sooner than them, you're probably going to win 99% of the time.
High damage situation, it doesn't take long to realize when you're outdone, you're outmanned in that situation.
And then if you're on the receiving end of that and somebody's just overwhelming you in MMA, you can just kick them in the balls and get 5 minutes to recover. No, I'm just kidding.
There was a fight not too long ago on the UFC where a guy got kicked in the nuts, I think, like 3 times.
Yeah, that was the Andrew Riddle fight. Was that it?
Bruce Leroy, wasn't it?
Bruce Leroy. Oh, no, Bruce Leroy. You're right. It was Alex Caracas versus the Hispanic cat that usually fights at 55 or something like that, right? Yeah, the great Jackson. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Armando. Armando was Armando Contreras or something versus Bruce Leroy?
Yeah, if a guy like Bruce Leroy can make it as long as he has with just a gimmick. You're gonna be fine in the UFC, I'm telling you.
Yeah, no, I agree with that.
Competition. Well, one critique I often talk about with the UFC is the supposed, you know, three strike and you're out rule. And I think guys should be given more chances once they become a name in the sport, you know, whether they win or lose. And the emphasis seems to be, you know, not really whether you win or lose anymore. Now the emphasis is whether you put on a show. And I wonder sometimes whether that kind of encourages more injuries. I haven't asked this question to a fighter in a long time, but it seems to me the whole sport is going more towards the striking because of the excitement and the crowd loves it. And even from the start of the sport, people would boo when it went to the ground and they didn't understand it. So it's kind of always been fostered that people want to see more striking action, which I think interests people more, but maybe you have a different opinion on that. What do you think?
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, nobody watches the show Spartacus to watch the gay, you know, the gay boys bang each other out and wrestle in bed on that show. They watch the Spartacus, kids, they watch the hot chicks, and the guys stab each other in the octagon or the Coliseum. And it's kind of like you said, the exact same thing. Nobody watches American Idol to really care about all the good singers on there. They like to watch the horrible singers and make fun of them. People like kind of tragedy. You know, people like to watch people fail and then win, the goods and the greats. And everything in between is kind of like the ground game, the jiu-jitsu, the wrestling. I love, obviously, martial artists love, all the fighters love and appreciate that. But the everyday fan, the way I describe that question to people that you just asked is, do you know what the biggest sport spectator-wise is in America?
Football.
It's NASCAR.
NASCAR.
It's what's NASCAR. When you come to lock, when you do numbers, it's NASCAR. Those are guys that turn left. Like, it's a guy in a freaking car that turns left four times. And, you know, 200, 300, 400, 400,000 people will show up to those live events, and they watch, and they go there because they want to see a crash. And I'm not getting on demographics of people, which, for the most part, I think the average NASCAR fan probably has less of an IQ than the average, you know, chess fan. That's the majority, though, of the country. If you look at NASCAR and WWF wrestling, that's what people pay and want to see. So you got to imagine, do these people want to see an articulate ground fight of guys playing a chess match and going from side control to neon belly to north-south, back to side control, back to neon belly to mouth, taking the back, the body triangle, to work in the chest? They don't know that. They look at two sweaty dudes wrestling, rolling around in a steel cage and spandex, where they want to see guys stand up and throw punches and kicks and elbows and knees, and that's what the majority of the people want to see, and the UFC has to cater to that because they want to make money. They want 400,000 people to show up their events like NASCAR and these WWF shows and stuff. As a fighter, is it frustrating? Hell yeah. Hell yeah. We're on the ground, and every freaking show, we're on the ground, and I hear this, knee! And I'm like, I'm on the ground, asshole. You can't even move here. That shit, I'm hearing these people yell louder than the people that are like, the Americana. You know, so it's, I agree completely. But I think the UFC has to market towards the masses, and the masses want to see knockouts. That's why they sell the Ultimate Knockout DVD a lot more than they're selling Grappling 101 with BJ Penn, you know?
Well, it's a sport that's kind of developed like baseball with the minor leagues and the major leagues, you know, and they even just called it the show, which is what they call it in baseball. So I think there's a lot of similarities there. And, you know, one thing that they always throw at you when they talk about throwing people out is, hey, you know, you use that as marketing, former UFC fighter, and you can go anywhere and make respectable money. And you can always make your way back. Some guys make their way back. So when I look at guys like Gabriel Gonzaga, who's actually a New England guy I met in person and interviewed, and just a regular guy, he retired and came back. So yeah, you can do it.
Well, I'll tell you I think that you might dig this little anecdote that I have. You know Joey Beltran, correct, gentlemen?
Yeah.
Okay, well, an executioner. He's one of my close friends. I love Joey. And he was released technically by the UFC after his last loss, after in a row. And he's one of the most exciting fighters around. Well, I thought it was amazing because in writing, they gave him a thing and said, if you drop the 205, win two fights in another show, we will let you come back to the UFC at 205, but you have to stay at 205. And they gave him that in writing. They said, win two fights, 205 in another show, and you can come back. And I think that's a huge step. I think that's a huge, huge step for the organization to give somebody that in writing and say, hey, go win 2 times at 205, because you also do a heavyweight, and we'll let you right back at 205. I thought that was great. You know, I'd never heard of that happening yet. And he told me that, and I was like, wow, that's a big, big thing, I think, for the UFC to be doing something like that.
Yeah, well, I think part of it has to do with there's not actually that many big guys in the sport. I think that's the reason why they really wanted to buy Strikeforce. More than anything, was to get all those heavyweights. you know, you look back to the days of Mike Tyson in boxing, heavyweights sell fights, and you know, they needed every possible one they could get, and you know, they're still looking for great heavyweights to beef up that division. I mean,
yeah.
I like Brock Lesnar, who had very minimal MMA experience, become a superstar almost overnight, just because he's a huge dude.
And it was crazy. I see these guys in person, trash bombs out of compound, and guys, you know, and then there's guys like, you know, Dave Herman and, you know, Steph and Struve, obviously, Steve in my head. All these guys that I see, it's incredible how big these little heavyweights are. You know, 6'7", 6'8", these guys like college football player linemen, popping around 295, dropping to 265, and I'm just like, oh my gosh, I mean, these guys are cut, they have a six-pack, it's 6'7", 300 pounds.
It's a funny story about Dave Herman. I actually met him down in Iowa, and he was so poor then, he had to borrow somebody's fight shorts just to be in the fight.
That's awesome.
You know, he was just he's a crazy character, too. When he got a chance to thank everybody, and he gets in the mic and he's like, I want to thank so-and-so winery for getting me ready for this fight. something about muffins. I never forget. I was like, what is this guy's deal? He's out there. But then I see
Did you know he dyed his body hair for his last fight?
No. Oh, yeah.
Did you tell how hairy? Yeah, he dyed his body hair black so he looked like a gorilla for his last fight against Tyson Fury. I think that's hilarious.
He's definitely a character. I mean, that's one of the things I noticed about him. He's like somebody that just seems naturally built for fighting. And he's also got a real crazy sense of humor. It's just funny.
He's hilarious. He's walking around all we were at this little organic food market. He was walking around with sandals and a pink scarf on. And I was just like, David, are you cold? He's like, I'm so freaking cold. I was like, why would you come out in the snow with sandals on? He's like, I didn't think it would be that cold. And I'm just thinking to myself, I'm like, can you hear what he's saying? He's walking around in the snow with sandals on. And he put a freaking purple scarf on. I mean, that's so hilarious.
But anyway, get back to you. What would you say you enjoy most about mixed martial arts? What do you like most about it, basically?
Me, personally, I like that there's no limitations. I think mixed martial arts is really a vehicle of your own expression. You can learn such a plethora and array of techniques, and if it works for you, use it, and if it doesn't, throw it out, but at least you've seen it and you know it, so if somebody tries to use it against you, you're somewhat familiar with it, whether you're doing, judo, sambo, krav maga, karate, kenjudo, Brazilian jiu-jitsu, catch-can wrestling, Muay Thai, taekwondo, boxing, doesn't matter. Like, you can get all these little things and just get one, two little techniques out of something, Wing Chun, anything, that goes, wow, this actually might work here, or this might work there. And then you can do colleague and weapons fighting, and then now you're fighting at a huge disadvantage because the guy's got a 30-inch stick and it's swinging at 125 miles an hour and a fist goes at 70, and incorporate all these different kinds of martial arts, advantages, disadvantages, wearing the gi, not wearing the gi, grappling with, boxing gloves on, so it's hard to land some ground and pound, all of that. So it's unlimited. And that's what I love about mixed martial arts is that hopefully there'll be some people like me and some more guys like Nick Diaz, and, in Machida, Anderson Silva, these guys have used more unorthodox styles of martial arts, the capoeiras and the karates and the sumo, incorporated with the four cornerstones of wrestling, boxing, Muay Thai, Jiu-Jitsu. And once people start seeing more of these techniques and some roundhouse and hook kicks and ass kicks and front kicks and stuff like that, I think it's so cool to watch a progression of the sport when you saw a guy with a gi armbarring people 20 years ago, and now you're seeing guys doing flying armbars, no gi, and flying triangles, twisters, and wrestlers, the wrestlers and guillotines. And that's what I love about it, is that you can go your whole life and not even be a great martial artist. I don't think anybody can be. You can be great at one thing, but you can never be a great mixed martial artist to be great at everything. And that's why I think it's the best sport in the world, because you have two arms and two legs, and there's nobody in this world that's going to be great at sumo, judo, jiu-jitsu, boxing, wrestling, Muay Thai, sambo. I mean, there's going to be nobody that's great at anything. You might be great at a couple of things, but not everything, so you can always learn. And that's exciting. Once you learn English, you pretty much know English. Once you play basketball, you can get better, but you play basketball, but you can't learn 30 different ways to shoot a three-pointer. You got to learn the right way, keep your elbow in, and your neck, and flip your wrist. In martial arts, a thousand ways to throw a kick, so it's pretty cool.
Awesome. And who would you say was the toughest guy you ever fought?
The toughest guy I ever fought? To tell you the truth, and I broke my foot this fight, my other foot, to tell you the truth, but that was more of a fracture, not really like a torn ankle. I mean, I'm not using this as an excuse at all, because I'm giving a credit for credit too. Edgar Garcia was one of the toughest guys I've ever fought. He fought in the UFC a couple times at 170, and he's had an up-and-down career since then. But until I broke my foot on his fucking head. I mean, I hit the guy, I came out of the Superman punch, and just, when you catch somebody, you feel it. Like, you feel your fist and that vibration, and then it's like the boom, right on the chin. And I know there's spot on the chin of a spot called, Vegas, VGS, and on the other side is 7 and 10. These are nerves, they're knockout points. Gallbladder 20, I'm sick of nerves. I studied human anatomy with my martial arts to see who's not at that point. And I was landing clean-ass shots on Edgar for a minute and a half, just head kick, knee to the head in the clinch, big elbow, Superman punch, you know, body punch to overhand. And I'm feeling these punches, like, penetrate and catch him. And, like, he's throwing punches back before I could even, like, realize that that was a clean punch. And I was like, man, this guy's a tough freaking dude. And he was probably one of the toughest guys I fought because I was catching him clean with everything. I ended up breaking my foot on his head because I kicked him so hard. And then I fell down to the sand and I got my foot and he finished with some punches. So they called it an injury, you know, TKO, a loss by injury. But I have to give the guy credit where credit's due. That guy was tough as nails. And he's one of my friends and stuff. So, you know, maybe a little biased. I haven't seen him in a couple of years. But that guy was tough as hell. You know when you catch somebody and you know when you hit him hard and clean. And when you're supposed to go unconscious, and you're like, what's wrong with your nervous system? You're not supposed to be standing up in front of me.
Knocked out. You know, whether it's or they have enough tissue around their brain to insulate it. I don't know what the deal is, but it's kind of interesting. You know, vagus area there, and the nerve endings. I saw a fight science show where they illustrated that pretty well. Not too long ago.
Yeah, I mean, you know, from boxing, dude, like, if you catch somebody and, like, they kind of look at you, and you're like, what the hell just happened? Like, I just swung a huge caveman at your head, and you just looked at me, and I'm like, oh, man, am I fighting a caveman here? Am I fighting a guy that's an MMA fighter?
One thing I wish I knew when I was fighting, I actually saw some scientist on an episode of this reality TV show that was all online called White Collar Brawler. They got, I think, a Harvard guy in who was an expert in brain studies. And he showed this literal study where they videotaped monkeys with these helmets on their heads. And then the helmet would twist suddenly, so it would force their head to rotate on an axis. And it was like exactly like a boxer or, you know, even an MMA guy getting punched directly on the chin with a hook. And they actually showed, you know, you didn't even have to take much of that rotational force. It would just knock the monkey right out. And it's the same way in fighting. It's rotational force. It doesn't necessarily mean you have to hit a guy hard. It's just you got to hit him right on the button. That's why they say whether a guy has a good chin or not. You know, it's all on the chin. If you do hit a guy in the right place on the chin, 9 times out of 10, if you hit him hard enough, he's got to go down. It's just, it's like predetermined the way the brain is designed.
I agree. That's hilarious. I want to try putting helmets on monkeys and let me punch him in the face a little bit. That'd be fun.
It was actually like a machine that would twist their neck and they get a monkey. You know, it seemed like it was that hard. It was just that violent slap of the brain against the skull is what actually does it. And I saw that, and
yeah.
I saw the video, and I was like, damn, if I had only known that, you know, I would have been aiming for the chin every time. I'm aiming for the chin. You know, in a boxing match, you're trying to actually, you know, use more strategy than anything. And, you know, especially in amateur boxing, that guy's got headgear. You don't think about the knockout all that much unless you're a heavyweight. I box 185.
Yeah.
Bombs with the chin all the time, and I threw nasty hooks in my dogs, too. So I was,
Exactly.
Now you know.
I'll tell you probably the best shot I ever landed on a person's chin. I was telling my student about it last night, because I was telling him, you know, about learning how to see punches coming at you. And I was telling him, I said, you know, he's getting a little bit more experience now. I said, I'm going to put the headgear on him, give him a mouthpiece, and I'm going to let him, but I'm going to throw some punches at him. But I'm going to aim the forehead where, you know, it'll say ring tie or Everlast in the headgear. So if he doesn't block the punches or flip the punches, it's getting hit on the forehead, so it's not making him gun shy until he learns a little bit better. And I was telling him a story. I said, you know, I was 1995, I was 18 years old, I was training down in South Philly. And I had 4 amateur fights at the time. I was 1-3. My only win was a stoppage win. I had stopped the kid in 2 rounds. And the other losses were to some guys that were pretty good. The one guy was, you know, regional champion that year, and I was getting better. But the trainer wanted to literally break down my technique and rebuild it, you know. So he was going real slow with me and teaching me defense and catch punches, foot punches. He had me in there with another kid who was about my size, about 5'8". He was about 200 pounds. He was a big, stocky kid, had cornrows. He just looked tough, looked mean. And the first time we were throwing some jabs at each other and we were, you know, practicing blocking and catching. And then he picked up the pace a little bit. So I took it back on him. And everything worked out okay. So then the next time we're working, and he started picking up the pace again, he was hitting me with some right hands. And the trainer kept admonishing him, saying, no, it's not the time to pick the pace up. You know, let's keep learning. And he would, you know, acknowledge me and tap gloves and do it again. Trainer looked at me before the fourth round and said, you know what, do what you got to do. And he threw a right hand, and I countered with a left hook, and I smashed him on the chin. And he draped over the ropes. I mean, he was out. And I went to finish the job, even in the sparring session, because the light turned on and said, go for the kill. And the trainer actually jumped over the apron and draped him and stopped it. And he goes, give me the towel. And I went to dabble my own nose, and he goes, it's not you. And I looked up from that one shot on the chin, and from the violent force of his head snapping, his nose was pouring blood. He didn't come back to the gym for almost 2 months.
Wow.
But that was a shot right on the chops, right on the chin, left hook.
Maybe he had
headgear.
That's nice.
I never heard of that.
Gentlemen, I hate to cut you off, but I got to go teach my kids class right now at 6 p.m. I'm putting up the future compound fighters, so they'll be in the UFC about 10 years from now.
All right, awesome. Well, it was great talking to you, and definitely good to hear you're staying active. Keep up the good work.
No, definitely been active. Everybody, and you know what we'll do? Follow up with you if you guys want after my surgery, and start to tell you some more stories about what's going on with that, and analyze some of the upcoming UFC fights and stuff, and take the pros and cons of the organization with you guys anytime. So I just appreciate the opportunity, and hopefully we'll talk real soon.
Yeah, we'll definitely keep our eye on you and everything like that. Is anybody out there you want to thank or give a shout out to before we go?
To first off, this interview up with Crossfire Media, my managers over at, you know, Paradigm Sports Management, my gym, the compound, and then Captain Jiu-Jitsu and Ramosa, Ground and Pound Clothing, and basically all the companies that support me, you know, Third Street Tattoo and Chiefs for the Fire Grill. Besides that, you guys, interviews would give me an opportunity to shout my sponsors out, and all my fights for my daughter, and the scope of getting her back one day soon, and thank you to all the fans who support me and follow me, and I'll be knocking for that, I promise.
All right. Sweet. Excellent.
Have a good night. All right. Thank you, guys. I'll talk to you soon.
There you go. There's Sean Loeffler. You know, I'm sure he's sick of talking about the ankle, but it sounds like he's got the Rolls Royce of insurance deals there, the treatment he's going to get for that. And, sounds like he's got a good head on his shoulders. He's probably one of the most articulate MMA guys we've had on in a while, huh, Tony?
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, I did a good job.
Yeah, yeah. You got both of us talking. He's a very good conversationalist, for sure. It was a good interview. We also, unfortunately, we don't have a boxing guest like I was trying to get this week. But we do have another MMA guest coming up at 9:15. So we got a little time to talk about some other hot-button issues. Here's that video, if we can get it to play, of Floyd Mayweather Jr.'s tirade against him from Dana White. Let me get that loaded up. But the big thing that we kind of brushed over is the Chisora versus Hay situation there over in Germany. I did get to watch a lot of the video, and, you know, I've been meaning to do it all week, and I actually only got to do it today. Here's Dana White before it stops.
First of all, I've got to think it's racist.
You're calling Floyd Mayweather racist. I've got to wait for it to blow. But anyway, I'm talking about Chisora and David Hay. What happened was, you know, they're basically at the press conference. David Hay seems to be the only one in the whole room who is actually, he has a bottle of beer, it looks like, in his hand. And he's standing at the back. You know, obviously there's a lot of press in the room. Cameras everywhere. He's in the back.
Yes, boy.
In a racist T-shirt. And they're having the press conference, and then something comes up where he has to open his mouth. He opens his mouth, and he's more concerned about Vitaly. And supposedly he and Vitaly agreed to a fight and money and everything, and Vitaly's not going to fight him all of a sudden. So, of course, you know, the promoter's up there trying to say, well, why don't you fight Chisora? And then the winner fights Vitaly again. Because Chisora actually did put on a great performance, I guess. You know, I didn't see it, but he actually had a very decent effort in losing, which I knew he was going to lose. You know, you look at their two records, and it's like, you know, why is this guy even getting a chance to fight Vitaly? But, you know, for whatever reason, they did fight, and he actually did pretty well against Vitaly. And Vitaly actually had to fight with only the right hand, from what I read, from the fourth round on, because he hurt his left hand early. And, you know, if he's anything like his brother with the jab, less jab, then that was a tough thing to do, but he did it. Anyway, bottom line is, you know, Hay kept yelling, you lost your last three fights to Chisora. So he took offense, and he wanted to kind of hype up the mood a little bit. He obviously likes drama. He slapped Vitaly at the weigh-in, made a big news about that. We didn't get to talk about that last week, but... You know, so he wanted to make a scene, I guess, and it was just maybe it's his nature. He's a little off his rocker like that, and a little like Tyson in that respect. But he ended up going right into the audience and going face-to-face with Hay. And from all the angles that I looked at, I could not see the hands of Chisora, what he did with his hands in those first few seconds. But it seemed to me like he was trying to say something. And I don't know whether the bottle was broken or not, but I'm pretty good at examining these things. And I saw it from like nine different angles, and I was listening too. And there's the famous picture now of the incident shows, looks like David Hayes landed a right hand. And if you look real closely, I think you can actually see the bottle is still in his hand as he's throwing the punch. So whether it broke or not, I don't know. I don't see any angle where you can tell if the bottle actually broke. But you can hear a tink, tink, tink across the ground. And it sounds like the bottle is still intact. So even though Chisora is yelling, he effing glassed me, you know, which is, you know, he broke a bottle on me. And you don't see it. You don't actually see the broken bottle being used in any of the videos that I saw. But... You know, David Hay does seem to be the one that threw first, and Chisora is getting all the blame for this and all the, you know, the flack because of, I think, the slap that he did in the first place, and just for kind of instigating it by coming off the podium anyway. You know, there's just no need for that. And then there's even another side to it because there's another angle where it shows David Hay walking up to Vitaly and smiling at him after the whole thing and shaking his hand like it was all like a stunt. And Vitaly, after the fight, is all saying that it was embarrassing. He was disgusted by it. Well, if you're so disgusted, why are you smiling and shaking hands at Hay after it's all over? And Hay didn't even seem bad, but his trainer's face was all messed up. And that kind of reminded me of the brawl I was talking about earlier that I was in. Actually, one of my friends who was in it with me, and I ended up being in this brawl against all these people in this house with, like, the three smallest friends I have. No group I came to this party with. And one of them, I actually hit him on the backswing and messed up his tooth. So, you know, this is my own friend. I wasn't even trying to go for him, and I hit him on the backswing. So I think that maybe what happened with Hay. And maybe that's when this guy got hit with a bottle or a fist. I don't know, but the guy thought he was hit by a bottle. And that's one of the parts where you get the actual testimony from somebody who's involved in the ruckus. But you really can't see much of the ruckus in the video. It's all, you know, you just got to, you know, listen to the guys afterwards and what they say. And the one thing Chisora kept saying was he fucking glassed me, he's saying. So that was kind of interesting. But one of the other things I can say is I have been hit over the freaking head with a bottle. So I know what that's like, and it creates a lot of blood. so I don't think that bottle was broken. I can definitely tell what an injury from a broken bottle on your head is like. It's nothing nice. And I'm telling you, a lot of people will probably overlook the sound of it, you know, because you can really hear that bottle. And if you've ever been at a party where somebody drops a beer bottle, when there's some left,
yeah,
actually, especially when there's some in it, it doesn't break very easily. There's videos on the internet of a guy trying to break a beer bottle over his head, and he can't do it. It's tough to do. You really have to come really hard down on the top of somebody's head to do it. That's how it happened to me. Somebody came down from behind like they jumped off the couch to do it. I broke right over the top of my head. So from what I think happened with the right hand coming with the bottle in, I don't think the bottle broke. But it just surprises me how Chisora is getting all the blame for this. And obviously, it was a big story, got people talking, but, you know, it's Tyson stuff. It was kind of interesting. And, you know, it's probably not something that really was staged, but makes Chisora look like he should retire. He's going to get fined. I think he already did get fined for the slap, but I think they're just going to fine him another $100,000 for the whole incident. They're talking about jail time for the both of them. But what a big story this week. It's been everywhere. But I just don't think people have looked at every angle of it and thought about it like to that level of what really actually happened, because you really can't tell. It's kind of weird as it sounds. There's hundreds of cameras in the room, but you really can't tell probably until you look at every single photo and every single camera angle what really happened in the heat of the moment there. The best angle I saw was from behind Chisora, and that to me looked like hey through the left bottle combo within the first half second of them coming face to face. And Chisora, I don't even see him have a chance to throw a punch. I think he just wanted to do it for the show, so he becomes the scapegoat afterwards just because he went down there first and you know, sort of egged it on because he was saying, say it to my face, say it to my face. And that's another thing, shows you probably didn't intend to punch him because he just wanted him to say it. You know, if you're saying to somebody, you know, say it to me, say it to me, you know, you're waiting for that to happen before anything. And he just punched him. So, you know, give the guy a break, I guess. It's an unfortunate incident, but it was definitely newsworthy. It's great video, great drama. And I think it was all natural. I can't imagine that whole thing was staged. Because if it was, nobody would have got hurt as bad as Hayes' trainer did with the blood all over. Anyway, did you read at all about that or anything? See any?
I heard about it. I did not really see the whole thing. I didn't get to see the fight. I heard Chisora did a lot better than expected. This was before Hayes' injury really was, or not Hayes, Klitschko's injury was really, you know, discussed. Also, I didn't get to see the fight on Showtime the other night, but, you know, I was talking to my boss at work, and he got a gift in that decision.
Oh, towards Bob. Yeah. Talk about controversy.
But I already got his ass kicked from there.
Yeah, our buddy Al Bernstein said it was like a travesty of justice. Just got robbed. And it was another fight in Texas where that happened. I think the last fight to be that controversial in Texas was Malignaggi versus Diaz, I think.
Oh, yeah, that was a bad one.
That was horrible.
That was a bad one. What was another one? Oh, I mean, we had another one down there that was totally botched. I can't remember who it was. But I remember Lawrence Cole was involved in it.
Yeah, that was another story that kind of got overshadowed by this whole deal over in Germany. But another thing, too, is Chisora spit water in the other brother's face, Vladimir. During the fight, I think, or before the fight, just spit it right in his face. And Vladimir, to his credit, didn't take the bait. He didn't swing back. That was That's good footage. But yeah, Taboris Cloud. Who was he fighting? Gabriel Campillo.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that I didn't actually see that fight myself, but that was unfortunate. Sounds like he definitely did not win that fight, and they gave it to him. So what can you do? We have another guest coming up. A couple minutes here. Just got to get his number up. We got, it's an Indian name, I guess. Bill Smallwood is his name. He's an MMA fighter. And basically, he's been out of the sport for 2.5 years. He's coming back now. I interviewed him way back when we were on MySpace page, if I remember correctly. And kind of came out of the woodwork this week. He's got a fight coming up, and he wanted me to interview him again. So, goes to show you how long people remember their interviews with me. So, Bill Smallwood, he actually has a fight with C.B. Dalloway on his record. He lost that fight, but shows him 0-2 on Sherdog, but I think he's had a few more fights than that. They just don't list them all. I know I've read stories about different fights that he's had, so it's documented, but Sherdog is interesting in case.
It's Bill.
Hey, Bill, this is Rabble Rousing Rich Bergeron. How's it going?
I'm sorry, is this?
Rabble Rousing Rich Bergeron from Fight News Unlimited.
Hey, what's up, brother? Pretty good, actually, man. Thanks for calling.
You're welcome.
Just got done taking a shower and being in the gym, so I'm kind of waiting on my trainer to get out. But what's up?
Hey, we just wanted to catch up with you and talk about your upcoming fight here. We also have Tony the Tornado on the line with us.
Hey, what's up?
Are we on air right now?
Yep.
Hey, what's up, guys? How you doing?
Yep.
Doing good.
Man, just working my tail off, man, here at the gym, though, so it's kind of like a 24/7 grind, though. I think maybe I need to catch up on some sleep, but
yeah.
trying to pretty much kind of live this lifestyle again, though. Anyway, how you guys doing?
Good. We had an interview with a UFC guy, almost UFC guy. I haven't actually fought in the UFC yet, but...
I know, I kind of like, because you guys had the lineup already ready. What happened actually with his ankle, though? What was the deal with that?
I basically was warming up, and it got caught in a crack in the mat, and came down on it the wrong way, and he tore a bunch of ligaments up. And basically, you know, they believed in him enough to say, you know, we're going to keep your insurance up to date and get you all taken care of, and basically make it possible for him to come back full strength. It sounds like he's getting like the Rolls Royce of medical treatment from those guys. So that policy. whether it's a
definitely, man,
at the event, you know, they take care of you. But
absolutely,
again,
man.
It wasn't no joke.
Wish they were. Wish they could treat my boy the same way, though, man. Kind of like take care of him. No, mow the wall, though. We used to wrestle back at the University of Central Oklahoma, though. But I guess he, I talked to him a little bit ago, though. I don't really want to put him out on blast, though. But I guess it was some performance enhancing. He had, like, kind of tested positive. But, I mean, I talked to him a little bit, though, man. It's just, we've been doing this stuff all of our life, though, man, you know, since college and even before that. I mean, I've been wrestling since 4 years old, but... you know, those guys back in Oklahoma, you get guys like that are in UFC, like Johnny Hendricks, though, man. He just got done in 12 seconds taking out John Fitch, and then Shane Roller, and, you know, Rasholt, all these guys, though, that come from wrestling backgrounds, though. I mean, I don't know, man. It's the same guys that I see on the other side of the world, though. And, you know, you see them in Russia, you see them, you know, wherever it is. And you're kind of like, hey, man, what are you doing? It's, you know, trying to make money at this, just like you are. It's, you know, it's interesting. But, Mo, I guess, got in trouble, though, with a performance-enhancing drug, though. And, I mean, he just said it was something like, you know, exploding. It was over the counter, and I don't know, man. I just kind of sad, though, because, you know, we're trying to make this thing a business. And you get to start thinking, though, that will any nutraceutical or pharmaceutical company ever touch you when it comes to sponsorship or, you know, trying to pay for maybe a flight anywhere or, you know, some of these sponsors that help you out, but it's kind of crazy.
Yeah, that's one of those issues that they're struggling with. There was one fighter that came out not too long ago and said that he estimates about 80% of fighters use some kind of banned substance at some point. And a lot of times it happens because you get injured, you know, and you have to recover. You have to work to recover because you got to make that next paycheck. You know, you don't get paid to train.
It does. Do you remember back in the day, what was it, when I was going through college, about 2000, 2001, you remember back when Mark McGuire was taking androstenedione?
Yeah.
And that became like the big, big, big thing. And the thing was is that it wasn't quite steroids. I think maybe it was maybe a quarter. It just kind of gave you that extra boost. So I remember I would take like a Pinnacle brand, and it was like androstenedione. And I always heard, though, if you ingest anything, it's going to go through your kidneys. So they said the best way brain pain to come in would be like, you know, through your bloodstream. So they have all these little supplements, nutraceuticals, and whatever things, and these little rub-on salves, so to say, and they put them on your forearm, or they crush the pills, and then they put them up under your tongue, though, because, like, if you ever look under your tongue, though, you got, like, you know, little blood things, though, and I said that I think that's a good absorption rate, though, and it's a lot better than actually trying to filter anything through your kidneys, because anything that goes through your kidneys, kind of like you've got to drink a lot of water to filter all that junk out. But you know, each their own. Whatever.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting too. We had Sean Shirk on the program way back, probably over 2 years.
I know. You remember whenever he was fighting Hermes Franca?
Yeah.
You remember like both of them were going for a title shot? So
we were talking.
And you remember, I think he had, Hermes Franca had just painted his hair like purple or something, and Sean Shirk, so.
He flat out admitted that he was on steroids for that, but Shirk contested it, and he actually showed that science supplements had a banned substance in it, banned steroid or something. And it was a pretty big deal, and I remember, you know, the UFC and Zions were so close at that point that they kind of swept that under the rug, but interesting.
I'm curious. I mean, I can't obviously. I think your show's sponsored by Zion, so let's keep a good taste in everybody's mouth. But
I'm sponsored.
I'm curious
by Zion.com.
Of course. I'm just curious though, just to kind of skate around the edge though. Was it just the money deal that they weren't hanging out in the middle of the ring? I mean, I know Harley Davidson and Bud Light obviously has got a little bit more maybe advertising budget, but maybe I just didn't really pay attention whenever Zions wasn't hanging out in the middle of the ring as a corporate sponsor anymore.
Yeah, basically what they did was once the Fertittas got involved, it's like they probably I hate to say it, it's criminal genius, but it was genius how they orchestrated the scam. They came in, they bought the company, they basically forced the company into bankruptcy when they got the ownership position over it, so they could come out of bankruptcy owning it. But while they went into bankruptcy, they decided they're going to default on a 3-year deal that Zion set up for that middle of the mat space. And around the same time where Dana White was making all those controversial statements like, we don't need Coke, Coke needs us. And he went out and made the point that, you know, they had other people coming to them. And one of them was Bud Light and the other was Harley Davidson. So basically what he did was use that agreement that he knew Zions was going to fold on. And he got to the negotiation table with the Fertittas and Harley Davidson and Bud Light, and they orchestrated a bidding war for that middle of the mat space that was always Zions. Even though they knew Zions wasn't going to be able to keep it, they made these companies outbid what Zions was supposed to pay for it, but never did. You know, so it's like
this is where I get a little hazy on the details, because at that particular point, Anheuser-Busch, which owns obviously Bud Light, they went from being an American company to a Belgian company about maybe a year or two before, though. And that, I mean, obviously, they own all the Busch Gardens, SeaWorld, and all that good stuff, and, you know, Bacardi and whatever. I've looked at the portfolio financially, But I just wonder how that, I mean, obviously they became, seeing that mixed martial arts became a huge international brand. And then especially like, you know, they got Fox locked up, FX, they've got ION channel. Man, I mean, I think they got, what, 6-7 networks though right now? They're doing it.
People really don't know, kind of, it's probably the most interesting part of my story, and the Fertittas kind of even avoid talking about it whenever they get interviews about the finances. You know, they're a private company for a reason. They like to keep everything close to the vest. And,
oh, man, I'm out here in Vegas. I understand it. Trust me.
Yeah.
Here's the thing, though, and I don't want to go too far off the deal, though, but the thing of it is this. They own about 18 casinos out here. They're called the Station Casinos. And a few are actually, you know, maybe one or two are on Indian property, but most of them are directed and marketed directly for Las Vegas locals. Now, they filed bankruptcy with those casinos, and there was only one company out here, a gaming company called Boyd Gaming, that was willing to buy up their debt, maybe 30 cents, 40 cents on the dollar. Now, the point of that was, is that they bid so low that, truthfully, they couldn't do anything. And the old man, Frank Jr., built that company from the ground up, like way back in the day. So either way, they did like a Chapter 11. No, they reorganized the debt. But little did people know that, you know, the highest paid MMA fight today was whenever Fedor Emelianenko fought Andre Arlovsky, and that wasn't even under UFC. Andre Arlovsky was getting trained by Freddie Roach, got paid 1.5. Now, forgive me, but to date, usually about less than 1% of the entire revenue for the entire fight card, that's the payout. Are you kidding me? Yeah, you got, I mean, boxing, you got guys like when De La Hoya fought Mayweather. What was that? Close to close to 80 million, 80 or 90 million just in that one fight. Just in that one fight shared. Forgive me, but they have Tecate out in the middle for a corporate sponsor. Would I take Tecate or Bud Light Pan me? So I say this. Whenever they got ready to, after they reorganized the debt for the Station Casinos, they have this newspapers online, et cetera. They have this I Love Locals program. So what I'm saying is this. They have these radio ads, and they say, Lorenzo and Frank Fertitta, you know, they cut personal checks so we could all keep our jobs. That's all fine and great. But you wonder where they get that money from.
Yeah. Well,
so
yes, they have
you
that
generally box. Think this.
Remember the car giveaway? They actually just started it again, I heard. But they had the big $5 million car day giveaway. And it was
absolutely.
And guess what happened? When they did the reorganization, they wrote it all off. All the debt from actually paying
sure.
those cars, it disappeared, basically. You know, nobody paid for it. It got written off by the Fertittas and the car companies. They just their insurance to pay for it or whatever. So it was a complete joke. They didn't have to pay for any of it, and they made money off of it. And that's how they did with the UFC. The same thing. They made a loan out.
I watched one
$50 million worth of capital to build that company into what it is today. And you know, they're still paying it back, and they still try to claim that the, you know, even way before it was ever at this level that it is today, they tried to claim the company was worth $1 billion, and people believed it. And it was all on borrowed money. You know, there was evidence of net worth, but they definitely need to think about it better. Anyway, it's interesting to talk to someone.
Man, you know, to each their own, man. I mean, like, I can't hate.
Yeah.
All right, brother. Hey.
They've done a lot of good things with it.
All right, good.
And I mean, we just got finished talking to Sean Loeffler about how, you know, they really do take care of their fighters in a lot of respects. But, you know, the base pay is still a bone of contention. And it's kind
of
like, you know, another Vegas industry.
When I read the news,
like
when I read the newspaper that they had just started offering insurance benefits, I was kind of like, that's interesting. But I kind of like actually how they did set up something for like the most Twitter follows, and you know, definitely because it is a business. So I mean, you know, you get guys in France, you get guys in Thailand, you get guys in whatever. And we need to build this thing a little bit bigger, though. But the truth of it is that every fighter will cut their throat. each other. It'll never grow. As far as that, so is there a solution for a higher pay? Sure is. It may not be one that Fertitta's like, and being in Vegas, but I'll make a suggestion that could be a fighter's union. And the only person that ever brought that up, though, that actually wound up stifling that back down because I think he lost what was between his legs, that would have been, Frank Trigg. He and his wife, though, I think she was managing him at the time, though, but anyway, they were with Clear Channel for a very long time, and he made a really, really nice suggestion that there needed to be a fighters union. And then he got back on the UFC cards, and then he just stifled that really, really quick, though. But trying to figure out, you know, where he is in the fight game these days, you know?
It's one of those things that I actually had a fighter off the record in an interview who was related to another big UFC fighter tell me the UFC, he didn't want to be in the UFC, he wanted to stay in Strikeforce, he said, because the UFC likes to keep you under their thumb. So they control a lot about what their fighters say, and, you know, it's like, it's a very big deal. And all sports are turning into that. I mean, you look at how many football guys get fined for making a stupid tweet, you know? You're under a different standard when you work for a private company like that in that kind of a situation, and you're supposed to be a role model.
Well, I mean, they don't like privatization, because, like, especially, like, with any of the subcontractors, whenever they need to build, like with Red Rock, which is a station casino out here, they're doing an add-on to their casino, and I know that they definitely use non-union workers. The same with Steve Wynn and the same with Sheldon Adelson with the Venetian, the Bellagio, or the Venetian and the Palazzo, and Steve Wynn with the Wynn and the Encore, though. They all use non-union, but that's the only three people that do, because the other people that you have is Caesars Entertainment, which they're, all their bartenders all are with, like, a local whatever it is. And same with MGM Resorts. I mean, they're all, you know, they're all union and stuff like that, though, because, you know, you need a ticket, you need to do whatever. And, like, you know, Vegas has got one of the worst economies, though, because people nowadays don't really have much of a disposable income. So,
right.
You know, whatever, though. That's why I feel very fortunate to have gone to college, though, and pick up, you know, background in finance and marketing, which is, you know, phenomenal, though, because, you know, most wrestlers go on, and the only place to go is the Olympics, even though that we hold the, you know, the highest, you know, the most medals and gold medals, like John Smith, Jimmy Monday, Danny Hodge, you know, whatever, and the most national titles, though. You know, and to me, just maybe this is not much opinion. I think it's just my opinion, but, you know, if anybody ever opens their eyes, MMA is made up of four sports. You got Muay Thai, kickboxing, boxing, jiu-jitsu, and wrestling. And out of all four of those, man, you got wrestling that will give you a scholarship,
right.
You know. And a lot of the guys, though, that have wrestling backgrounds, like Chuck Liddell, I mean, he's a damn accountant. For God's sake, you ever wonder why all those fights were ever after April 15th?
Yeah.
Yeah, guys that are like, what is it, what's his name? The school teacher, he was at 185, he was a champ before Anderson Silva knocked him off.
Rich Franklin. Yeah.
And then you got, what is his name? The old boy from Georgia that came out here to Vegas. What's his name?
Boris Griffin, is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, Boris Griffin, yeah. He's got a political science degree. You know, all these guys, though, that they're either school teachers, they got finance degrees. Like, I think, I mean, everybody else kind of knows him as King Mo, but I know him as Mo the Wall. But, you know, I think he's like, you know, he has a degree like a school teaching and stuff, though. You know, these guys have backgrounds, and they're very eloquent, though. But the truth of it is this. When I generally think, like, when I got a fight coming up, like March 31st,
right?
I know in business, like, because I still work on the telecommunications floor. I work in sales and stuff like that. I know at the end of the day, when it comes to business, people love winners. When you're in business, winning is being in the black, and losing is being in the red ink. So you know you're dead, and then people have to outsource jobs in India, China, and Mexico, and go for a lower bid. And the same in the cage or the, you know, the octagon, or whether you're fighting in a boxing ring or whatever it is, though, winning's winning, though, and that's all people understand. Either you got opportunity or you don't.
Right.
So,
try
to look at things differently.
But your comeback here, you know, it's obviously been a while. I remember I was just talking to Tony earlier saying the last time I interviewed you, I think Fight News Unlimited was just a MySpace page. If I remember correctly.
No, man. I remember. I remember because I had, like, my trainer back. I was in Pacific Beach in San Diego, and I remembered that you were doing online stuff, and I don't even think I had, like, a site photo at that time, though. I remember you'd ask me pretty much, like, about, like, 10 or 11 questions or 12 questions or something like that, and it was neat, though, how we worked. And then I think that I wound up having a really interesting, I'll put it that way, I don't like to gum anybody out, but had a really interesting business partner come up, though, and he was a web developer for the Los Angeles Times, and we wound up starting MMA-Underground, and there was a lot of guys that had a lot of bad taste in their mouth because they thought that that was the underground for MMA-TV or MMA.TV or something like that.
Right.
And they had a forum, and they had a real bad taste in their mouth. It wasn't until that I had a guy named J.P. Baru, though, and he was my business partner at the time, though, that he wanted to re-engage on a contract, because I knew I was going to have to put in about 6 months of hard work and then pretty much wash my hands of it, sit back and, you know, that's it, collect money, that's it. I just thought, why this is the investment, though, but he thought otherwise after he started meeting a few celebrities, a few, you know, hookups and business people, that because I don't try to burn anybody in business, because the truth of it is that in this game, you can only be a fighter for so long until your body starts falling apart. And then if you burn your bridges and you wind up acting like some moron like Nate Diaz, which I don't really care for the guy, though, because I used to be with KJ Nunes and all those guys. But
yeah, he's a punk.
Anyway, I mean,
I was disgusted with him when he...
Can you imagine?
He gave the middle fingers to the camera that one time after he lost. And I thought he was watching.
I mean,
and he turned himself
around. I think he...
I didn't understand why everybody was up in arms about how great he was all of a sudden. He's lucky.
Yeah, maybe he's taking away Gomez, remember, back in Pride?
Yeah, everybody...
And then he lost the bill because, he was smoking weed. And then, obviously, retired just recently. Plan, though, and he just said, I'd much rather smoke a joint. I'm going, ah, man, come on, brother.
He's got a prescription. I'll give him that. He does have a prescription for it.
Yeah. I mean, even Cali, though, man.
Yeah.
That's North Cal, especially, though, man. Like, North Cal, I mean, shoot, man.
Yeah, he's talking.
That's where all the hippies are.
Boxing, and, he really knew how to play the system, and he did.
Oh, man, when Gracie backed him and said, I think everybody should be like Nick Diaz, I was like, man, come on, bro. I mean, I talked to a guy last night, though, that used to be with his fight group, though, and I was like, what do you really think about Nick and Nate? And they're like, I just be truthful. And he said, I think they're wonderful with children because, you know, I think a lot of people will always tell you this, though, that fight game is kind of a poor man's sport. I mean, even way back with boxing, fighters and stuff like that, they're all hard. And it doesn't mean that they can really take a lot of beating. You want to get inside the mind of a fighter. I mean, they can take a little bit of physical abuse, but the real part, whenever they really start taking abuse, it means that they've had some really tragic emotional hurt in their life. And they have to be able to tell their mind that I've been in worse places.
Right.
To keep forging ahead. I mean, this was a guy like John Copenhaver. They used to call him War Machine. I remember when he was on the Ultimate Fighter. He was getting his butt beat bad. I mean, and I think the guy covered his guard, and he shot his knees up into his armpit, though. He was taking off on his head, though. He wound up switching over on one leg and then wound up rolling him through on the counter and then wound up teeing off on dude's head. And wound up winning, though, and he was just all bloody and beat up, man. I was like, man, that dude's got heart.
Yeah.
And anybody loves that kind of fighter. I mean, in Japan, I know what's up.
He's going back to jail, actually. War Machine.
I'm sorry?
He just got busted. He's going back to jail. one of the we had on the show a few weeks ago, if I remember correctly. He violated his probation or something. He's got to go back to jail. So he was in jail.
Not good, man. I think that they wound up dumping him out of San Diego to be like somebody was like mouthing off outside of the gym, and he used to be with Undisputed Gym out of San Diego, out of Northtown, and wound up choking somebody out or, you know, whatever, though. But, you know, I mean, that's not for me to, like, really air anybody's business stuff because, I mean, I'm going to be honest with you, though. I have been out of the game, really and truthfully, because, and I'll just say this only on, you know, only on his show, because I think that a lot of people face alcoholism. And whenever I met a lot of people in the industry, and I met a lot of people in the nightclubs, and I, you know, I dated a girl, though, that her dad owned quite a few nightclubs, and, you know, whatever, and just met a ton. You know, a lot of narcissistic people, and I've been around egos my whole life, though, and I just wound up feeding into the energy, and then, you know, a lot of fighters are adrenaline-based, and then they love chaos, though, and then whatever, though, man, I think I literally just, like, talk BS to people and bouncers and whatever, though, and I wound up having to go to meetings, man. That's the only thing that really truly keeps me on the level playing field, though, because, and, you know, I'm a big, you know, avid supporter of the meetings because it does. It keeps me...
Well, everybody
you know,
I've ever heard of who got involved in AA just swears by that, you know, that you got to keep going to these meetings and just, you know.
It is, man, because it's a daily routine because... I mean, it's not the fact that I really want to, like, go and, like, hang out and listen to people, how they destroyed their life, but this is what I really need to hear, because on a daily basis, I'm the type of guy, though, that does not really need to really hear, like, a million compliments. I already tell myself on the reason why I can win.
Right.
What I really need to hear is that, you know, whenever you become self-will, run riot.
I think I could have got caught
just,
myself.
You're like,
I had a really bad alcoholic semester in military.
Well, man, I thought most of it was like, you know,
boxing that got me back straight and narrow and you know, to stop focusing so much on partying. I went right back to it my senior year. never really got to the point where I had to drink alone, you know, which is where they said you really turn. But, you know, I come from an Irish Catholic family. You know, that's my mother's side of the family. I had 10 kids.
I see.
Every party we'd go to, it'd be fueled by alcohol. I mean,
that's the
tradition. And I know you
I just know in the entertainment industry.
Right?
Go ahead. Let's get a question.
A Native American background, right?
Yeah.
That's a
I don't know. Yeah, the truth of it is, I don't know one successful Indian drinker, though.
Yeah.
And I think the thing of it is, at least what I've, like, you know, kind of done a little research on, most natives, they are what, diabetic, lactose intolerant, an alcoholic. And all that has to do with, like, sugar. They say they can't metabolize the sugar. So when most normal people start drinking, you know, after they have a few drinks, though, you know, they get sleepy. Well, the way that they may ferment alcohol, though, is sugar. So whenever they're trying to burn that sugar off, you know, whenever the party's still going on in your head, and Fergie and Will I Am are still banging in my head, and there's a party still going on in my head, I'm still like, yeah, keep going. You know, if I don't show up, they show up, you know, and they keep partying without me. So I'm kind of like, all right, my head's still going. And
I've had a couple of moments of not remembering what I did the night.
Feeding into that self-delusion.
Getting the stories from people.
Yeah.
Oh, you were over here. You were doing this. And I don't even remember that.
Yeah.
that's always...
Well, you get those constant incomprehensible demoralization that people keep seeing in. There's only so long that you can keep being a douchebag until, like, people just completely just...
It's really ever
messed
with you. Oh yeah, you went over and gave some money to an orphanage. It's never something like
that. Yeah, I mean, no, you can't.
Yeah, dude,
you buy it on
halfway down the street. You know? Something stupid.
Yeah.
I remember when I was in college talking about you know, drinking and partying a little bit. The one incident was actually going to be tomorrow is the anniversary. It was
we've been having our annual show at Lock Haven University, and I will never forget it because it was my roommate's birthday. And, you know, I fought him hard. I won. And I snuck a bottle of Zambuca back into my room because I really wasn't much of a beer drinker at the time. I would always, you know, drink either the vodka lemonade or the Zambucas or whatever. I'm like an idiot drinking Zambuca like I'm drinking a mixed drink. You know, I have a glass of it for it, and I'm just a sip of it. Well, next thing you know, we were watching Dumb and Dumber. And about into that movie when they had the scene where they got the tuxedos and stuff, I had almost killed the bottle by that time. I was smashed out of my mind.
I'll tell you something that's real thick.
Yeah, it is. It's real thick, man.
I used to drink, like, champagne, and it wasn't because, like, the stuff tasted good, because I'm from Oklahoma. I'm, like, two convenience stores in one stop, like Kingston and Medill, Oklahoma. Now, I didn't grow up on champagne, high living, stuff like that. My thing is this. I drink champagne because of this. It's carbonated, and you can't down it. That's the hardest season to drink.
Well, my senior year, first of all, I'll say, the Zambuca vomit does not smell good. Our dorm room, we had all the windows open. That black licorice vomit smelled nasty.
Oh, my goodness.
That was pretty rough. My senior year, I had moved off campus into a house, and we were the party house on campus. So most of the time, I was working like a bouncer because I was always training for fights. I would, you know, have a party here and I'd party there a little bit, but I was always training for fights. So I would always work the door and be the bouncer kind of guy. I remember the night of our annual show. I was doing a lot of the promotional work to the night before the show, helping set the ring up, getting some stuff ready for the show. Had to go in the sauna, lose, a pound or two, normal shit. The next day I go, and then there were some people over my house. They were having a little party, but I was ignoring it, because I wanted to focus. So I went and closed and locked my door. I went to sleep. And the next morning I got up, and I got up early because we had an early weigh-in, and I know I had to go at least check my weight and possibly go back in the sauna. And I'll never forget it. I got up, and there was about six of my roommates. They're like, "Hey, good luck. We'll be seeing you tonight." I'm like, "Are you guys really up at 7 a.m., or have you not gone to bed yet?"
That is, you could wind up in a place like Vegas, and like you see the sun coming up, you're kind of like, "Ah, no big deal, man. I'm just going to go to a pool party and keep the party going." Yeah. But the good thing, to get off that subject though, because I don't like to stay too much, that stuff. So I just want to try to say, what happened and what I'm doing now. And what I'm doing now is that I get to hook up with, good guys like my trainer, Jason Tafoya, man. And, I can't say enough good about the guy because he's like a living role model because I see him and he gets to interact with his daughter at the same time. And, he gets to train me and, gets to kill two birds with one stone. And, we work on a strike, man. We, go everywhere together. It's like a bromance, I think, for lack of a better word. I got a girlfriend, named Samantha, and, I think probably every now and then she probably gets a little jealous probably at times, though. But, I can't say anything bad about, my trainer, though, man. We go to phase one gym, though, quite a bit, though. And then right after that, we hit our little workout at LVAC, though, or Las Vegas Athletic Club. And, he's a really humble dude, though, and he keeps me. What's up?
I was out in Vegas for almost a full year last year. I went out there, I think, late February, stayed till November. And so very familiar with the territory there. One thing that's nice about the area is, the strip is the strip, of course, and you got casinos all over the place and in the outskirts.
Sure.
Doesn't take all that long to get to a mountain. they're everywhere up there. And you can't beat the weather most days. I did see snow once. While I was there, but no accumulation, of course.
You can't beat like the fighter atmosphere. I mean, my trainer and I, man, we sit here and we talk about what other place could you literally go from gym to gym to gym? Because every once in a while, whenever you get up in the bigger weight, so you got to go and seek out a different guy to spar with. But what place could you really go to that has like world champions almost in every gym though, because this is fight capital of the world. It just doesn't get better than Vegas though.
Yeah,
that's why a lot of guys come here. I mean,
Randy,
I'm not much of a desert guy. I love the water. What's up?
I met Randy Couture at his gym out there. I saw a grappling event right there that he was at, and you know, of course,
yeah.
Wanderlei Silva's gym. I've been in there, and
yeah.
And it's just all kinds of different places you can go for MMA, and of course, boxing too. You know, boxing gyms are everywhere.
Yeah,
I got a lot of good opportunities. Never would have got out here in New England just by being in Vegas for those few months. But actually, you know, you still see clips of me every now and then in actual ESPN news footage of the anything about Mayweather because of the one workout session, open workout that I did that was just jam packed with media before the Ortiz fight. And I just happened to be standing next to Leonard Ellerbe, Mayweather's manager, on the ring apron. I didn't even know who he was at the time. And, you know, just standing there, and I'm on half the clip that they show on TV still, just from that day.
I know. It's all interesting, though, because everybody's feeding, and it's kind of like every now and then you find yourself, like, you know, under the spotlight, and you kind of like, well, who was that guy? I mean, I rolled into my gym at phase one, though, and you know, I get to shaking hands with people, you know, I need to do some bag work and work on my cardio, and, you know, it's been two and a half years since I've been out of this stuff, and the crazy thing is that, you know, I got a world champion in my gym, though, and he's getting ready to go for a title shot. His name is Babu Shimov.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe. Yeah, Babu. And little do I know that Babu is, like, you know, the champ. I'm like, I didn't know. I'm, like, trying to speak Russian to him, like, hey, and I'm, like,
he's
just,
one of those
you
guys,
know, comes in, shows
his... He's got, like, a Fedor camp. He's got, like, the M1 people on his back, so they, you know, they purposely put him up against punching bags, I think, but he definitely... I know that. He's a good fighter. But he hasn't really been tested.
Yeah.
He definitely would...
Well, we got him and... What's Dewey's last name? Dewey Cooper, though. Black Cobra. And he's got some pretty good Muay Thai down. And I think Bellator's got him a fight coming up here pretty soon.
Now,
so,
tell us what brought you back to the sport. How did you get the call to fight again?
Yeah, I started doing 2 days working out, and I realized, though, that I always wanted to be MMA, though. But, you know, I wound up losing my actually with a boss actually pulled a police on me. And I wound up going to another sales firm, and we were outsourced with a communications company. And I knew the product. And anyway, it wound up being Freddie Roach's brother that owned the place. So it's kind of neat, though. So, like, Al Roach. And... All right, brother. Thank you, man. All right, we'll see you tomorrow. Yeah. Anyway, Al Roach would, you know, tell us stories about, like, how Pepper Roach and Freddie Roach and all those guys, though, they used to, you know, work in the sales floor, and then they would go boxing, you know, right afterwards. And my trainer actually works on the same sales floor as I do, so... You know, he'd always been trying to tell me, he's like, you know, we need to get in the gym. And I'm like, okay, well, tell me when. He goes, you know, just show up. It's right over here. And I Googled it on my phone and showed up, never left. I was already doing 2 days on my own. And once we left, this is your gym now. And then I was like, I really need to work on my striking. I said, I know my stuff when it comes to wrestling. I said, I've been wrestling since the age of 4, college in Oklahoma, on a wrestling scholarship, wrestled D2. And I'm like, you know, I said, we won like 2 national titles while I was there at UCO. So, you know, the crazy thing is that, you know, even the same guys that are even in business now, like one of my buddies, Matt Dodge, you know, he's got a clothing company called Nearfall Clothing, though, that he's going to be sponsoring me on my next deal, though. It's neat because, you know, all these guys are like my brothers, though. And they're so poor that, you know, I kind of had some, like, rough patches in my life, though. And if I'm not going to do it now, then I would never get back into it. So I just feel hungry. And when I mean hungry, I don't mean like hungrier than food. I mean like hungry as in like I'm going to come eat your your dinner off your plate in broad daylight. So it allows me to wake up at 4:30 in the morning, get on the grind, get some miles in, hit my office at 6 in the morning, grind till about 2:30, get off, immediately go to the gym, and then work out for a good 6 hours, though. Get a lot of cardio in, a lot of sparring and, you know, footwork and whatever, though. And, you know, I got a lot of respect for my trainer, though, because he's out here grinding with me.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, we just lost a guy.
So,
we used to do that with Marvin Hagler. You know, we had a guest on a couple, few times, more than twice, I think now, Iceman John Scully, who still spars with his boxers. But Goody Petronelli, the guy I'm talking about with Hagler, he used to do the runs in Cape Cod, on the beaches of Cape Cod, even though he was wearing sneakers and Marvin Hagler was wearing combat boots. He would still run every step of the way. Goody, he just died in his 80s, but he was...
Oh, man.
Till he died. And,
the real thing that really gets me motivated, though, is because my mother used to tell me, and my mother used to coach me, like, from, like, about 4 years old, like from wrestling, and she coached me through three national titles as a little kid, and my mother knew absolutely zero about wrestling. She used to pay attention to practice, and I would really just be lollygagging around, and then she'd take me home and put me down on the carpet and make me do little sit-outs and stand-ups and stuff like that, put plastic bags around me and stuff, but the point I was trying to make is this, is whenever I see those kids that have on, you know, the shoes that don't maybe fit their feet or they're different color or maybe they're from humble beginnings or whatever it is, but they're making it work. You see their heart and they got a lot of technique and they're working what they're supposed to do. And my mother used to tell me, she goes, you can always tell somebody who really wants it. She said, because when you're a young kid, you can't just go out there and buy the Nike shoes. You can't buy the Adidas. You can't buy the Champion gear. You can't buy all that Under Armour and stuff. You got to do with what you got. And, you know, boxing, wrestling, you know, MMA and stuff like that, you know, all that, a lot of that gear costs a lot of money, though. And a lot of these parents are still working, like, you know, sewing jobs. And, you know, they're pretty much enjoying this nice economy, bad economy with the rest of us. So, you know,
my first
not everybody comes from...
Not necessarily poor. We weren't necessarily poor growing up. My first heavy bag was actually a pillowcase full of my old toys tied to a speed bag.
I love it.
And I had a pair...
No, and you see these guys, and they hang on. I mean, you know, like a Russian kid, though, and Sam, man, you got to calm them down, though, because he'll work until, like, he beats his muscles down. And, you know, I see these guys, and they're hungry all day, every day. And they're not doing it for money, though. And it keeps me motivated because I know that I make, you know, fairly decent in my job, though. And it's not that. It has nothing to do about the money. It's just this. I understand winning.
Right.
And I know this. I know that I'm good enough. So I take it one step at a time. Take this next fight, this guy named CJ Martin, and I've worked with Joel Lopez before. He's with Ringside Sports Bet, and I mean, we're going to go down there to an Indian reservation, though, and hook it up in the octagon, and then right after that, I'm going to piggyback off, and then I got probably another fight with, what is it, these guys out in St. George, I think it's CFC or something like that, but they just got done packing an arena, like, for 3,000 max capacity. I couldn't believe it. So I'm going to try to talk to either Mark Cuban or his guy with Edge, DNet Fights, and maybe try to broker something with that. Anyway,
I got a couple emails from Mark Cuban back in the day.
Kill two birds with one stone. What's up?
I got a couple emails myself from Mark Cuban back in the day before he invested in the UFC and their bond. But he was actually following my story, which kind of flattered me at one point, but he actually emailed me back when I sent him a couple emails, so he's a busy guy, and
excellent.
He answers his email.
I think it said we had about, what, 90 seconds?
There you go. It's all you.
But nonetheless, what's up?
Give us your final thoughts.
Either way, Rich, man, say that again?
Go ahead. Give us your final thoughts or whatever you want to say.
Nah. Final thoughts, man. I know you've taken yourself, though, from, you know, it kind of seems like man, you're doing your thing, man. I'm kind of stoked, though. I mean, you're doing your thing on the business end, though. You're getting, you know, Zion to back you guys and sponsor you guys, though, man. Thank you for having me on. And, you know, I just want to give a shout out to all those guys at, you know, Las Vegas Athletic Club and Ladies One and my sponsors and stuff like that. Man, I can't say enough. Those guys helped me out, though. And anywhere that I take my little network to, my girl, Samantha Michaels, though, man, my trainers, okay. And my mother, Smallwood, so, you know, can't say enough, man. Dud and those guys over at Birch Communications. So, shoot, thanks for having me on, Rich.
Thank you, and have a good night. And,
all right.
We'll keep in touch. Good luck on the fight.
All right, brother. Thank you, sir.
See you later.
All right, bye.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.